This is Listening to the Dead.
Uncovering the secrets of forensics today.
I'm Linda LaPlante, novelist, producer, writer of 150 hours of TV and 33 crime novels. And truthfully, I don't think one could have been completed without the assistance of the police, especially my close friend Cass Sutherland.
Hi, I'm Cass Sutherland, former detective and CSI in the Metropolitan Police Force.
This is episode 2, Fire Investigation Forensics.
Which is one of the oldest forms of forensic investigation. The Great Fire of London was probably the most famous case, an investigation that traced the fire's origins to the bakers on Pudding Lane.
I know, but they never conclusively established whether it was arson or an accident. They arrested and executed a French watchmaker who was believed to be an agent of the Pope, but he was later proved to be innocent. So it was probably, in my estimation, I think, an accident after all.
Yeah, and London wouldn't get a dedicated fire brigade for another 200 years.
And do you know it only got its first police force 4 years before the fire brigade?
That's a little bit before my time, Linda.
Oh, no, no.
But I found as a CSI that nowadays fire investigators, be they scientists or members of the fire brigade, actually work very closely together when they're investigating fire scenes, particularly murders involving fires.
I know, because that's really very interesting for me because my new book, Buried, focuses on the damage from a fire. And I needed so much help from just fire experts and forensics.
Do you find that sort of knowledge useful as well in writing to create crime scene red herrings?
Oh, yes, definitely. And it was actually at one of the forensic at Olympia, one of their events, and I was talking to the team of forensic officers that were there specifically to discuss fire and what to do. And they showed me a small video of a fire that was absolutely engulfing this property. And the statement from the witness that said it had started in the back room and suddenly she had been overcome with smoke and what had happened to, I think there was a fatality. And they got her laptop, and when they examined it, they knew she was lying because it wasn't scorched and she was working on her laptop at the time frame she had said the fire had begun. And so they backtracked to actually find the exact time that fire took hold. And I found it absolutely riveting to be told that they could pinpoint not only the time the fire began, but the place it had begun. So even though there had been an inferno eventually, they knew exactly where that fire had been started. And to me, that is absolutely extraordinary.
I found one of the interesting advances in fire investigation was they trained dogs to be accelerant sniffers. And in a few cases, actually used them because what they found was that when accelerant burns, of course, it burns away and it becomes harder to find it. And we would have to just take samples from areas that the fire investigator would indicate, well, I think here and that, sometimes by smell. But when it wasn't smell, it was just like looking at the burn patterns. But these dogs, you'd bring them in and they just, poof, there they'd go. And you'd get the little squeaky ball to play with because he'd...
But they're also so incredible, the dogs, the sniffer dogs that are trained to find the source of the fire. But they have special booties because they're often going into embers of fire that has only recently just been quashed. In that, again, you know, you can pick up a book and you find somebody's written about a dog searching in a fire. You go, where is his booties? And that's why, for me, the experts are important because they double check
For Buried, you did your research, and it was with Dr. Peter Manzi, who's one of the world's leading fire investigators.
Correct. And he went through the entire description of the opening of the book Buried, and he only had one note, and he said your lower windows would have come out, blown out first. And you think, it's so good to actually double up. But when you have an expert, you very, very rarely will need anyone else to confirm he's correct, because he's stunning, his knowledge. It's spectacular what science can produce. And I remember I was on a panel in New York, and there was a man there who had been accused of setting a light to his family home. And he had been found guilty because they had found what they believed had been accelerant at his front door. But in the end, he was able to prove with fire scientists that what had happened, the heat of the house had actually moved his heater, which had banged against the front door. And if you think about the recent horror of the fire, where the couple were found guilty, you know, of setting a light to their own home, and tragically, these children, I think there were six children, died in the fire. Yeah. And again, before the fire experts could really bring everything to the table, one of the police officers, and this is when physicality often matches with scientific, one of the police officers noticed that the father of these children was acting. As the news kept up and my babies are burnt, my God, my children, he was acting. There were no tears. He wasn't crying. And that police officer said, there's something wrong here. Meanwhile, your scientists brought the evidence. The same can that had been used to set that house on fire was found in the trailer that belonged to this couple. It was extraordinary as they pieced together what horror this couple had done.
Peter Manzi actually done some work on Grenville, and they were looking at the fire cladding and doing testing on different types of fire cladding to see how quickly it would ignite and other sort of forensic tests. Let's listen to his interview. Today I'm in leafy Hertfordshire, and I'm just making my way to Fire Investigations UK with my trusty little King Charles Spaniel Disney, and I'm going to meet Dr. Peter Manzi. I've known Peter for quite a few years, and he is, without a doubt, one of the country's leading fire investigators. Come on, Diz.
Hello, Kaz, how are you?
I'm great, Pete. Good to see you.
Been a long time, mate.
Yeah, it has been.
Good to see you. Looking well. Come in. Who's this? Your new arson detection dog? Hello, Disney. Hello.
So these are your offices in the wilds of Watford,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but notice, as I walked in, that picture there,
yeah.
I've recognised that right away from my days in working in South London.
That's...
You worked that case, did you?
I did, yeah. That was Lackenall. And unfortunately, six people died there. So that was in 2009, so you'd have remembered that.
Yeah, I do. I remember seeing it on the news and the pictures of it.
Yeah.
So was it an arson? Or?
Well, it looked like an arson, because if you look at the different flats that are on fire, it actually looks like you've got the main fire from the ninth floor up, but then we've got this fire on the fifth floor and the seventh floor. And this is where burning material fell out of the building, and the wind was blowing against the building that day, and it actually blew bits of material back into the flats. And if you notice, some of these windows pivot on the bottom and some hinge on the side, and it was the ones that hinged on the side that were open that the stuff could blow back in and cause these other fires. So we thought it was an arsonist at work at first.
But it was, and that was in the summertime?
It was. It was first week of July. So it was, I think it was the Wimbledon semi-finals. All the windows were open. About 4:20 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So it was, but there was another twist to this, because the young lady that discovered the fire, it was believed that she'd set the fire. So, as you know, those were the days I was in the London Fire Brigade. So myself and the team and the forensic scientists who worked with the fire brigade, with the police, we all worked together, did a thorough job of excavating the room of origin, and we discovered the remains of a television in there where the contact switch, which she'd switched off about 5 minutes before, had actually stuck together, and they welded together and generated a lot of heat. So that started the fire inside the television, which then caused the power supply to short circuit and cause an arc.
What, when you say an arc?
So you've got the copper, one positive copper conductor, going against an earth or a neutral and short circuiting.
Yeah.
So you get a little bead of copper on there, and that will survive after the fire. So because we found that inside the television, we then followed the lead through and found another short circuit outside the television. So if the one outside had happened first, it would have blown the fuse and you wouldn't have got the arc inside because there'd be no energy. So, but that was a challenging investigation. And often, as you know, it's not just the identifying the area of origin and where it started, but what caused it. You know, what was that ignition source and that fuel package that brought them together? What was the mechanism? So was it an accidental, deliberate?
Is it hard to tell if it's an arson or if it's an accidental fire? Is there a fine line sometimes?
A very fine line. And often it's a case of having to do reconstructions as well to see if you can replicate it and put it to the test. You can have ideas that you make sense, but when you do the test, you can actually prove it's not what you thought it was.
Because interestingly, if it was a suspected arson and somebody was arrested, the police would do the interview.
Yes.
But I wondered, did they ever consult with the fire investigators to say, well, look, you need to ask these questions because we need to know the answers to them?
The thing is because the police are so good at interviewing, but they may not have the technical knowledge that we've got with fire dynamics and fire science. So in this case, I was allowed to sit in with the detectives as they interviewed the young lady, and I'd already got a list of questions that they'd interwoven into their list of questions and delivered it very, very well. So if I thought there was something that needed to be added to it, I could do that, which was unusual.
So there was somebody who was actually arrested?
Yes.
And interviewed?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day?
Yeah, it was
good
clearly,
investigation showed that no, it was nothing to do with
her. It was an accidental fire. And with this particular fire as well, we reconstructed one of the rooms in the flats. So the only way you could tell it apart from a pre-fire photograph that I'd obtained to the test rig was in the test rig, there were thermocouple trees hanging down. We had the motorbike in there, the barber's chair.
Thermocouple trees, they're heat readers, aren't
they? Yes, they sense that detect the heat. So you can get the temperature at ceiling level about half a metre down and half a metre increments down to the floor. So you can tell when it's going to go to flashover, which is when we say a fire in a room becomes a room on fire, when the radiant heat comes down onto all surfaces in the room and ignites them all at once. Come and have a look in the laboratory, Kaz.
Can you take us through a sort of scenario? There's a fire in a house. Fire brigade go and a body's found. What sort of course of action would be taken?
Well, I think now, Kaz, having worked years together, the fire brigade and the police, the relationship's getting stronger and stronger, and there's a lot more cross-training. So people are understanding each other's jobs. So even down to the first attenders on the fire engines, they're being trained on scene preservation. So in the old days, you'd go there and everything would be out in the garden. They'd even wash the floor thinking they're doing you a favour. And now I've been to murder scenes like you where the fire crews are being so careful of preserving the evidence, you've got to remind them they've still got to put the fire out, you know. So if the officer in charge of in a fire brigade wants to understand what caused the fire, because they haven't got the training to do fire investigation, just basic training, or they suspect it's a crime scene, then they would call out a fire investigation officer. And they would also inform the police. But the fire investigation officers are normally there very quickly, they can secure the scene, make sure that everything's preserved, identify evidence that is visible and is not going to be damaged by them being there, even down to cigarette ends where they might find a dustbin lid and put it over there and put a marker on it and tell people, you know, put barrier tape up. That's the best way to do it, is preserve the scene, make sure nothing can be destroyed, even if it means shutting it down for the night and coming back in the daylight hours to do it.
Can you just take us through how it all sort of worked and examining the scene?
Yeah, sure. Again, we know we've got a victim, there's a body there, and it would be easy to be drawn to that part of the scene, as it were. And it's really important that you hold back, go back to what we were saying about marking out your boundaries, but going from the area of least damage, documenting everything from the broken window. Who broke it? Was it the firefighters that broke it to get in? Was it already broken? Was it somebody forcing entry? Is the glass on the outside or the inside? This is where we work with your guys on this, but you've taught us this for us to learn. But once we've seen that, we then preserve it. So once you've done all around the outside, you go inside the building, and now you're looking at all the indicators that to tell you where the fire started. Because the fire might be remote from the victim, but it's the smoke that's killed the victim, not necessarily that they were burnt. Because until you find the area of origin, that might be an area within a room, but the room of origin, you're not going to find the cause. So you need to determine the area of origin. We'd be looking at smoke patterns, staining on ceilings, demarcation levels on the walls where the smoke is stuck to the walls and then it's clear underneath, to see if it decreases or increases with intensity and in height as you walk along a corridor, for instance. But the biggest effect on these fire patterns is ventilation. And this is why we need to know, was a window open during the fire? Did it foul during the fire? Then give a wrong indicator that maybe the fire went a certain way, because the fire is going to travel towards the air. So getting back to where the fire started is paramount to the investigation, because until you can clearly define the area of origin, you're not going to find the point of origin, and you're not going to find that ignition source in that first fuel package. Now, if we've determined it is in the room, for instance, where the victim is, we'll then start looking at the fire patterns in that room. And you may see a demarcation line, perhaps a few feet off the floor. And this is normally where you've got the products of combustion coming out through the door, if the windows haven't fouled, for instance, or even in an early stage, coming out of the door, filling up the rest of the property, and any air that's available is coming in to feed the fire. So you're going to have a clean mark at the bottom with the air coming in. Even the carpet won't be burned if you've got this air rushing in, cooling it as it's going in, because it's feeding the fire. Well, if air's rushing in, then there's a fire burning. It's another indicator this is where the fire started and took hold.
One of the things we used to say in the police was, think murder till the investigation proves otherwise. Yeah. And if you do that, you're going to take everything. You know, you can take everything. You don't need to submit everything to the lab.
No.
And it must be the same for in arsons. You don't need to submit everything.
No.
What would be your sort of priority submissions that you would feel these are the sort of things I would need to, you need to get tested first at a lab?
Just be methodical and don't rush. Take your time, work together, document everything you're doing. There is so much to consider, from evidence that is going to be lost, CCTV, alarm data, witness testimony, stuff that is going to be destroyed because of the weather. All these things you've got to protect and make sure that it's available if you're going to take this to court. You need the evidence. As you know, Kaz, what do we say? What you leave at the scene, you lose at the scene. And I don't know any investigator that hasn't got back and slapped their head or punched themselves and said, I forgot to ask this. I'll give you a quick example. So I'm investigating an oven fire. Very nice house. I've spoke to the owner. I've got the timeline sorted out. I've got all the information I need. I've photographed this scene million times. I've even used a 3D scanner that we use on the scene. It's a small contained oven fire. It started in the oven, end of story. I've got the oven to bring back here to our laboratories, wrapped it up, put it in the back of the Jeep, and I thought, well, I'd better use the firm's app before we leave. I'll get to contractor, and I think, she never mentioned contractor. It was so easy to assume, because she never mentioned contractor, she hadn't had any work done on it, because she would have said, wouldn't she? Mm. So I thought, practice what you preach. I got out of the car, went to the owner and said, I'm really sorry to ask you, have you had any work done on the appliance recently in the last couple of months? She said, the morning of the fire. Well, my jaw nearly at the floor. I said, you sort of didn't mention it. She said, well, it didn't have anything to do with the fire, did it? I don't know, it might have done. You know, what were they doing? And it forces you to ask her. And again, can you imagine coming away and you think, I didn't ask that, or I didn't look?
Well, quite often people who commit murder then commit arson because they think that they're going to destroy all the evidence. Certainly near the end of my time, there was a development coming on in trying to get fingerprints from, where even walls were covered in soot.
Yeah.
Has there been any advancements in that?
Still progressing? I was aware of, I think the Met were using latex, and I know another company was using latex, where you would put it on the soot and paste it on and it cures, and you pull it away and everything else is left underneath, and you can see fingerprints, blood spatter. Arsonists believe they set a fire, they destroy evidence. And we know they actually create evidence that's there. And it's finding that, and it's being found. It's finding that a competent ignition source, there's lots of ignition sources, but it's the competent ignition source and the first fuel, the first material that catches fire. Once you can find that, you can say, well, how did they come together? So what was the mechanism that brought those together? That determines, it's that action that determines whether it's an accident or deliberate. And that's why everything's got to slow down and make sure we've got all the data that's available at the scene to develop all the potential hypotheses that exist for that scene. Because once you've got those, you've then got to test them. And we go back to maybe doing a reconstruction to say, oh, this doesn't work. You know, we thought it might, but it doesn't.
Well, I mean, I had a case where we suspected that the suspect had put the petrol can on the side of his car because the dog, the fire dog, totally reacted to it. But we sent it up for chemical analysis, nothing.
Yeah.
But the scientist said, he said, sometimes the dog's nose is better than the equipment
we've
got. Oh,
without a doubt. We did some projects with London South Bank University, which was our study for my degree. And one of the projects we did was, how sensitive is a dog's nose? And comparing it to a GCMS, it was hitting on, because we knew it was there, but yeah, we weren't getting the results through the lab. So, but unless you can get the results through the lab, you haven't got a case.
You can't put the dog in the box.
No, exactly, yeah. As much as they'd like to.
You mentioned earlier, we were talking about scenes, you said about 3D photography. I'm just interested in how you use that.
Okay, well, when I worked on Lackanell, the police used 3D scanning so that you can actually move around the property and capture the trueness of it, as if you were there. Very expensive CAS to use, you know, and you had to pay people to process it and everything else. But it's come on so much. If there's been one thing that has really come on in leaps and bounds, what we do is document the scene. That is the most important thing. If we're going to present to a jury a scenario, we have trouble looking at 300 photographs of a scene and what it means, and it's difficult. You still need your photographs. So we were out in the States 2 years ago, and one of our colleagues had this 3D camera, and he brought it and he showed us, set out with his iPad or phone, and captured the room we was in. We were so impressed, we ordered two, we've now got six, and we're getting another four, so that every member of our team has got one when they go to a scene. Because once you've captured it, it can sit there in the cloud, never to be used. But you want to go back to it in a year's time, 2 years, or when this goes to court. Try and remember all those. So you've taken 10,000 photos since then, whereas with this, you can move around and walk around. It's like Google Street View. You can walk out of here, out of the office, into the laboratory, into reception, and you can even wear 3D goggles.
I was going to say, is it like a form of virtual reality?
It is virtual reality. You can put your phone in the goggles, and you can move around the whole scene. But the other thing you can do, which makes it even more invaluable, you can tag bits of evidence, and you can click on that bit of evidence, and you can then open up a movie, a photograph, a lab exam, a report. Doesn't matter how you communicate it, it's making it understandable to the layperson. And I think this is one of the issues, apart from the complexities of the arson investigation, why the prosecution rate's been so low. You've got to explain to a jury, beyond reasonable doubt, this is the reality. And we've got the tools to do it, so.
Well, thanks very much, Peter. That has really been a very interesting time here, and it's great. It's a bit like going down memory lane, but also learning about the future of fire investigation, and I'd like to thank you very much.
Ah, it's been great to see, because it's come on a bit since we started.
And it's your round next?
I think so.
As a CSI investigating fires, particularly fires involving murders, I'm working alongside Peter Manzi. I learn a lot from him, but I think in turn, he learned a lot from me as well about how detectives investigate cases. And I learned a lot about fire simply because I had no knowledge or understanding of fire other than what I'd been taught in a classroom.
I think, Cass, that one of the areas that most fascinates me in the way that the forensic fire scientists can track the fire, the soot markers, the airflow, it almost becomes as if it's a living thing.
Yes, it does. Peter himself did a case for me where we thought we had two seats of fire, and it made the husband look even more a suspect. But it actually turned out that the flashover had tracked across the ceiling, hit the curtains on the far side of the room, the curtains fell down, landed on a chair and totally burnt the chair out, whereas other furniture wasn't so badly burnt. But it wasn't two seats of fire, it was just the cause of a flashover. So that kind of knowledge that they have actually allows you to say to the detectives, no, he may not have done this. So it's looking at both sides of the possibilities, but listening to the experts.
It's been fabulous talking to you about the fire scientist, Cass, and also big thanks to our expert. And for me, it was especially fascinating because, you know, I needed so much advice for my new book, Buried. But, you know, very, very early on when I began my writing, I was asked if I'd like to go to a forensic department to actually watch how they work. And at that time, you know, I really said yes to everything because I was so desperate to gain as much information about everything as possible. And I was told that if I was, you know, given permission to watch the process of everybody working in the forensic lab, I was to sit in a corner and not say anything. I said, oh, yes, I will. I will keep my mouth shut. I won't move. So I've got a hardback chair in a corner, and there may have been about, I don't know, 8 desks with technicians, assistants, all working on their microscopes. And it was really quite boring because they weren't talking at all, and I'm sitting there, and they're not really doing much, except they kept going backwards and forwards to an enormous double-doored fridge. And I could see them taking out little plastic bags, returning to their tables, not speaking to anybody, going back. And I thought, I wonder, are they eating sandwiches or something? I mean, I couldn't tell what they were doing, going in and out to this fridge. And then these double doors banged open, and there was a very young male scientist, and he went to the fridge, opened it, slammed the door, and he said, all right, which of you have got my right foot? Somebody's got it somewhere in this room, and I want to know where it's been moved to. And a rather portly woman goes, excuse me, what is this about a foot? There are only for small specimens in there. What is this about this right foot, and why is it in this fridge? He said it was a fire victim's skeleton, and it fell off, and it was told to me it had been brought to this fridge. It's a right foot snapped off at the ankle. And from the back of this room, a voice said, oh, I think someone's taken that. I haven't got it. I haven't seen it. Thank you very much. The doors banged, and I remained sitting there until lunchtime. And that was my first indication that a limb could snap off in a fire.
You've actually used that in one of your books.
Next time on Listening to the Dead, DNA and blood analysis.
This man was found, he'd been stabbed a number of times, had his throat cut lying by a glass table in the lounge. But he was initially sitting in a sofa, on a sofa, and he'd been hit with a full bottle, uncorked, of red wine. And there was red wine spattered all over the sofa and all over the walls. And this is no joke. Initially, it was so difficult to differentiate between what was blood on the walls and what was red wine.
Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books. Our producer is Chris Attaway. You can subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening now, and a new episode will pop up in your feed every week. Until then, thanks for listening.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Listening to the Dead. My new novel, Buried, is out April 2nd, 2020, in hardback, ebook, and audiobook.